in my hand a rock from the Valley of Elah. The Valley of Elah is in Israel, and it is the place where David fought Goliath. As a matter of fact, I brought one that's fairly area dynamic. And what does that mean? It means that this would be the type of stone that David would have picked up and he would have put in his slingshot. Now you might say, Dr. Davis, look, it's a little bit hard to believe to attack somebody taking down a giant with a slingshot. Well, of course, the ones we sell at Walmart, you're probably not going to do a whole lot of damage with. But the reality is that a person who had a slingshot in David's day could probably get something like this up to around 50 miles an hour. And so could a 50-mile-an-hour rock take you out? I guarantee you will. Would there be anybody who would like you to just stand and let me? No, okay, Jim. No, I'm not like that. Well, the truth of the matter is our story today is not just about a historical event. It's about faith. And what is it a faith about? It's about facing your giants. Because the reality is all of us will face a giant. And I'm going to say that your world is perfectly imperfect. What do I mean by that? Anything in process is by definition imperfect. And so I'm going to tell you that God has created this world perfectly imperfect. Why? I'm going to even say it in a way that you might not like. I'll put it this way. No matter how great your life is, I'm going to promise you that troubles will come. Why? Jesus said it, first of all. And so there's our first clue. And second clue is I just don't really know anybody who hasn't had troubles in this world. Or to put it another way, this is not heaven. For us, our homeland is heaven. Or to put it another way, and it isn't meant to be. And so why would God make something that's perfectly imperfect? Why would he allow giants to be in the land? The answer is, because by fighting giants, we discover more about ourselves. We discover more about God. Deuteronomy 8, 2 through 4 says this, I took you into the wilderness so that you would know what was in your heart. You see, it isn't that God needs to know. God really already knows. And so he takes us into these situations so that we would develop our faith and trust in him. And so, he has placed you providentially for such a time as this. Well, how did David do it? Well, the story, oh, it's not working.
You go get you.
Oh, I hit you?
I think you did.
Or maybe it was the Holy Spirit, I don't know. Don't say amen, Pastor.
Amen with that rock.
Shall I switch? Is that working?
And it can, it's off. Right?
It's off, okay.
That hand will always work.
Yeah. That will always work. Now, I don't know how I hit mute.
Mute.
Mute, it
didn't mute too, but I, yes, because in my back pocket. No, okay, so that's a little better, huh? Do you want me to take this? I always appreciate a person who takes a stand. All right, back to our teaching today. So our famous story is about David facing the giant Goliath. Now, what you may not know is that Goliath is a leftover giant. Now, what do we mean by a leftover giant? You see, the Israelites didn't go into the land the first time that God wanted them to take him into the promised land because, in fact, there were giants in the land. And actually, there's an area that was known for giants. It's called Gath. And it's called the Anakin. And Anakin's just another word for giant. And the scriptures tell us that, in fact, that Israel did not conquer all of the land. Where does it say that? Deuteronomy 1, 28 and 29. And it says that one of the areas that they didn't capture specifically is the area called Gath. And, of course, where would Goliath be from? Well, the answer is Gath. He's one of the leftover giants that just wasn't conquered. And so we begin with our story of David, but it's not just David's story, it's your story too, because all of you are going to have to face a giant. The worst kind of giants are the leftover giants, the ones that seem to crowd out our present and threaten our future. And while they might come from the past, they keep showing up with regularity. And how do we get rid of the giants in our life? At a certain point, we have to face our giants. We have to face those things that make us draw back in fear. We have to go from the mountaintop into the valley. Now, when I say this, this isn't just a metaphor. This is actually historical, exactly talking about the way that the battle was fought in Israel. And so I have been to the Valley of Elah, where David fought Goliath. Here's the rock. And I will tell you that I've seen the encampments of the Israelites on one mountain and the Philistines on another mountain. And in between these two hills, mountain be too strong of a word, these large hills, is the Valley of Elah where David fought Goliath. Now, here's what happened. Goliath would come out, and he was a champion. Now, back in David's day, and we think even in Greek thinking, or not thinking, but fighting, you would bring out your best warrior, and your best warrior would challenge and say, bring out your best warrior, and if I defeat him, then you're our slaves. If he defeats me, then we're your slaves. And so Goliath is doing this. He walks out and he says, hey, bring your best guy down here. Well, nobody's going. Why? Well, because he's a kind of tall guy. How big were Israelites and how big was David during this time? The answer is most historians believe David was about 4'12", 4'11". Do you remember how tall Goliath is? He's almost twice the size. And so he looks like a giant. By the way, if you've ever been to Europe, you'll notice that if you go into a castle or something like this, the doorway is about this high. And you have to watch it. I've actually hit my head. Even though I'm not that tall, I've hit my head on one of these doorways. And I remember my daughter saying to me, Dad, how come they made the doorways so small? And the answer is because that was the height of people back then. Human beings, by the way, are growing. I'm getting taller and wider. No, you don't have to worry about that. But the simple truth of the matter is human beings are getting bigger. And in David's age, they were really about 4'11". So when he comes upon Goliath, this guy looks kind of big. And what happens is Goliath comes out and he begins to curse the God of Israel and curse the Israelites and make fun of them and mock them and do things like that. And so the Israelites are up on the mountain and they're thinking, yeah, okay, we're not happy with that. Maybe you should come up here and fight us. And so what would happen is that they would raise the battle cry, they'd march down the mountain, Goliath would appear, and they'd go back up the mountain. And you're like, wow, what a bunch of cowards. Well, it was more than just they were afraid of Goliath. There's some technology here so far as warfare is going on, and the Philistines were more advanced than the Israelites. The Israelites were, frankly, fairly primitive. Well, what did the Philistines have that sort of scared the Israelites? Chariots. And so you can rather imagine you're on foot and your opposing army has horses with chariots on them and they have these little spike things that as they go along, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Gladiator, it just cuts you to shreds and they don't even have to touch you. They just have these little sharp objects that happen to kill people as you're going past. So the Israelites did not want to fight them in the plain or the valley because they were at a disadvantage. But yet, the Philistines weren't going away. And here's our first point. You're going to have to face your giants to get rid of them. Because the history of Israel says that they're not going anywhere. But now it's become a problem because they've decided that they don't want to just remain in Gath. They don't want to remain on the shore. They want to take Israel's inheritance. And that's what fear does. Fear takes your life. Asked a good friend of mine who's a PhD in psychology, if you had to put your finger on one thing that was more debilitating than anything else, what would you say it is? He didn't even hesitate. He said, fear. In other words, fear takes life from you. It stops you from doing the things that you would like to do. It binds you. It controls you. It makes you go into a corner, and there was a lady in my church who had a family member who was afraid to go outside, and by the time that she was done, she was afraid to leave her house, then she was afraid to leave her room, and finally she would not move from a corner. She stayed in that corner. Fear is one of the most debilitating, one of the most threatening, one of the most powerful things that affects human beings. And the Israelites were scared out of their mind. And it just reinforced their fears when they saw this giant, and they thought to themselves, there's no possible way. We can't win this battle. We're just simply going to have to stay here and be ready to go concede to a draw and hope that they'll go away. Except giants don't go away. They keep coming for more and more until you take a stand. I remember that I was hired for a new job, and one of the things that happened the very first week that I was there is that my boss said, I have some behavioral plans that you need to sign, and I was hired to write behavioral plans. And he said, so backdate these and sign your name. They're about 3 months old. And I said to him, I'm sorry, what did you say? Did you say backdate? He goes, yeah. And I said, well, that would be lying because I wasn't hired at that time. And so I would be signing something stating it's not true. He goes, yeah. And I said, well, that's wrong. And I'm not going to sacrifice my morality for this company. And he looked at me and he said, you are so narrow-minded. I can't believe that you would let your morality get in the way of us getting money. And then he said, do you realize that people might lose their jobs if we don't get this grant? And I said, well, number one, maybe you should have thought of that 3 months ago when it was due. Number two, I'm really sorry about that, but I had nothing to do with it. And number three, the price is still too low for my morality. I'm not going to pay that price. And he goes, give them to me. I can't believe you. And he signed them all, and then he looked at me disdainfully and says, I don't understand you people. It was interesting because a few weeks later, he dropped by my office. And he says, I have something I want to share with you, and if you don't mind, I'd like you to keep it in confidence. And I said, sure. And that was just one of many times when he would stop by my office. And one time he said to me, you know why I like talking to you? And I said, no. He says, you're the only person that I trust in this whole organization. Well, the simple truth of the matter is that's called teleological ethics, and what it means is the ends justify the means, but what I said to him is, no, I'm sorry, I don't think it does. And you're going to have to find a workaround because I'm just not going to stop being moral. The reality is that you live in a world that has fallen. You live in a world where people are more than happy to sacrifice their morality for whatever helps them get ahead. And when you take a stand, it can be unpopular. And when you stand for anything, it can be unpopular. But the reality is that in order for us to actually have a faith, there's a point where you have to take a stand and you have to stand up for what you believe in. And so our faith teaches us that David is a hero of faith. And how does he become a hero of faith? Because he says that he has learned to trust God before he ever got to this giant. In other words, he said, I took the lion and the bear, and God helped me with them. And so the way that we grow in our faith is the present difficulties that we have. That is the point where we exercise our faith, and we begin to believe God in the here and the now at this particular moment. Giants are always going to be there. But it doesn't mean that God is going to deliver you from having to face giants. Not at all. As a matter of fact, it appears as if God wanted them to face them the first time. They just didn't. Well, how do you do this thing called facing giants? It's kind of simple to a certain degree. And what I mean by simple is, I just mean to say that if I were to tell you, you would probably already know. It was just a matter of reinforcing to you what you did know. What is it that you have to do to face a giant? First, you go. And what I mean by go is you say to yourself, I'll go. I'm going to accept this challenge, whatever it is. And you're going to have challenges for sure. And so it's good to learn them now before the bigger giants come along. So you're going to say to yourself, I'll go. Second, you're going to say, I'll fight. And so this is exactly what David did. He heard this person uttering curses and he goes, you know what? I'm not okay with this. I'll go. Now Saul says to him, I don't think so. You're too small. And he says, not only will I go, I will fight. And then the third point is, I'm going to win. I'll go. I'll fight. And I'll win. And what's interesting about this situation is that, in fact, Israel was promised the promised land. When did they actually get all that was promised to them? Not until David. As a matter of fact, when you read Joshua and Judges and things like that, you'll read that they're still in the process of trying to take the land. They hadn't got it yet. And so who was actually able to inherit the promises of God? It was David. And the nation of Israel was not fully realized in the promises that God had for him until a man of faith came along and believed that God was bigger than any giant. How about you? You might say to me, I've never had a giant in my life. I know that's a lie. I know it's not true. And I know that God has placed you in a situation providentially for such a time as this, so that you might realize who you are and who God is. John Calvin said it very well. He said, God is like a mirror. The closer that I come to him, the more I see myself. And so it's so true. We discover things about ourselves in the midst of this battle, which in fact is life. I'll go. I'll fight. And I'll win. And David says to Saul, this Philistine will not get the better of me. I've been there. I've done that. I've already placed my faith in the Lord before, and I know that it's going to work. But let's be clear. Even the greatest heroes have to reach the point of faith. They're not born that way. You see, Abraham's the father of faith, but if you read real closely, he's not full of faith in the beginning. As a matter of fact, you might remember that he goes to see the Pharaoh over in Egypt, and Pharaoh takes a liking to Sarah, and he goes, that's a nice-looking woman right there. Why don't you come be part of my harem? I don't know if you saw this part in the story, but Abraham says, well, that's my sister, which, by the way, it was a half-sister that he married, which you might say, that's really weird, common in those days, because you wanted to stay within your tribe. Abraham leaves one little point out. Oh, that's my wife. So where was his faith when Abimelech says, hey, Sarah, you look sort of nice. Come on over here. The answer is Abimelech never learns that this is Abraham's wife until God speaks to him in a dream. And he says to him, you touch her and you're a dead man. Now, where was Abraham in all of this? What was he doing? The answer is cowering in fear. And let's even talk about the promise of the child. Remember, Abraham says, you know, to God, God says to him, I'm going to bless you. And Abraham says, that's great. But the reality is all of that's going to go to my servant Eleazar. Here's what he meant by that. That's really nice, God, but I don't have any kids. And back then, to not have kids was a big deal. Very big. And so God calls him outside and he says, look up the stars. That's how many kids you're going to have. Look down here. That's will be your descendants, not kids, but descendants. And God makes him a promise that through Isaac, he's going to have all the descendants that he saw in the sky and in the seashore. So let's look at Abraham as a hero of faith. It's not happening right away. Sarah's not getting pregnant. And so what does Sarah say? Well, you could have sex with Hagar. And Abraham says, not at all. I would never do such a thing. No, he doesn't. He goes, okay. And did God say that it would be through Hagar? No. He actually says specifically it's coming through Sarah. As a matter of fact, the name Isaac means laughter. Why? Because when Sarah heard it, she started laughing. And God says, so you think this is a joke? Here's the name of your son. Laughter. David is a man of faith. And he believes that God is up to the challenge of the promises. But not everybody starts off as a man of faith. I'll talk about myself. When I started a church, and I sometimes tell people that I was there for 19 years, but only because most of the people were probably new to church who came to our church and didn't know that they could probably go somewhere else and get a better pastor. But it worked. But the very first year I was there, I remember walking to church depressed because it wasn't going well. They couldn't pay me a salary. And I just thought to myself, boy, oh boy, I spent all of this time in education and training for what? And I would be more depressed each time I go to church. I didn't tell anybody because I didn't want anybody to know how little my faith was. But then finally, one day, I discovered how to defeat this thing. And I remember saying to God and to myself, even if I've really messed up here and you really didn't even want me to start a church and I just thought it up, the one thing I'm sure about is that I wanted to do it for you. And so even if I'm wrong, I'm right because I want to do it for you. Same thing happened with Anchor House. I spent 1/3 of everything they had in the bank my first month. I told my wife, this will be the shortest executive director in the history of Anchor House because I've got another 2 months at the rate I'm going. And I preached in a church, and I told them to pray for me. And a lady walked up and handed me a check for $30,000. And I went, okay, maybe this will work after all. So great heroes are made where no one sees with the lion and the bear. And because they've learned that lesson in the wilderness, now they're ready for the giants. And now they're ready to believe God for even the big stuff. How about you? What if I told you you're just a stone's throw away from taking down your giant? What is it that you have to do? Like David, you have to believe in a giant God, bigger than the most giant problem that will come your way. And I'm pretty sure that's the only way to do this thing called life. By the way, you say, well, that's a nice sentiment. Well, actually, it's an empirical study done in science from Duke University. What study? People who believe in God and are active in their faith live on average, not everyone, but live on average 7 years longer than people who don't believe. So maybe we should do a second service just to increase your lifespan. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's no question that this story is not just a story that happened in history. It's our story. And if we could begin to believe like David, we too might be able to see the benefits and the way that battles can be won. Whether it be at Anchor House, whether it be when you go to see the doctor, or whether it be in our everyday lives. Well, speaking of the doctor, I had an accident when I was skiing, and I always say this story with some trepidation in Florida, because when I say skiing, most people think I'm talking water, and this was snow skiing. And I'm a little bit of a risk taker, and so what happened is we were skiing in whiteout conditions, and that was called a blizzard.
Now, generally, smart people don't ski during blizzards because you can't see where you're going. I do not say that I was in that company. I was more like, I'll be fine. Well, I wasn't. I hit a ledge and took a fall. But when I fell, I landed on my hand and my thumb snapped in three places. I went to the doctor here in Lakeland, a hand specialist, and she said, I got to hand it to you. No, she didn't say that. I'm sorry. She didn't say that. But she said, Dr. Davis, your thumb will be fine. And I said, great, wonderful. Well, it didn't get fine. And I remember that it hurt. And I remember thinking, she doesn't know what she's talking about. And so I went back to her 6 months later, and I said, listen, my hand still hurts. And she said to me, are you moving it? And I said, well, you know you gave me these exercises to move my thumb, but, you know, every time I move it, it hurts. And she goes, that's normal. I said, I don't think you understand. I don't actually like pain. So is there a way that we could get past the hurting to the healing? She said, no. She said, Dr. Davis, your body wants to heal your thumb. But until you believe that the healing is greater than the hurting, you will never be healed. And I remember thinking, I don't think I like that idea. Maybe I'll start to move it a little bit and see if, in fact, I can get the use of my thumb again. And it did hurt. And I had to make a decision. Which did I believe more in? The healing or the hurting? And finally, I went back to her. And I said, isn't there any medication that you can get? No, I'm just saying. And I just went like that. What is the story of the gospel? That in the end, the healing power of Christ is greater than all of the hurting power of this world. That's why I'm at Anchor House. And that's why we're here. Will you stand with me now and sing Just As I Am?